Welcome to CHOAT's Intellectual Property Insights podcast series, hosted by intellectual property, litigation, and corporate attorneys covering trending topics at the intersection of science, technology, and law.
Welcome to CHOAT's podcast series on PTAB proceedings. My name is Eric Berendet. I'm the co-chair of the IP litigation group at CHOAT. And with me is Mike Chenal, who's a chemist in our IP group. We're going to talk about an issue that comes up actually both in litigation and PTAB proceedings with some frequency. In these matters, it's not uncommon for patent validity to be challenged based on an argument that certain prior art references inherently meet the limitations of whatever claim is subject to challenge. Proving inherency is always difficult because, by definition, you're trying to demonstrate the existence of features that are not expressly disclosed in the cited prior art reference. To prove inherency, it's often necessary to conduct experiments to recreate what's disclosed in the prior art reference and then conduct testing to show the presence of the inherent feature. Concepts seem simple, but in practice, there's some real challenges that have been illustrated in some of the cases, including a couple that we're going to talk about in a minute. You've got to get an expert to conduct an experiment that affirmatively shows the inherent features of the disclosed prior art in order to prove the patent claims are invalid. What sounds simple in theory can be quite fraught in practice, particularly when the expert is subject to cross-examination on the experiments that then are going to be presented. The following two cases that I'm going to turn it over to Mike to describe illustrate some of the challenges. These cases involve, they're PTAB cases that involve situations where experiments were conducted, in one case to prove inherency and in the other to disprove it. And what you'll see is how these cases play out show the nuance and challenge of presenting this type of evidence in adversarial proceedings, whether you're talking about it in the PTAB or even in litigation in district court. So, Mike, I'll turn it over to you to walk through the two PTAB cases where these issues came up.
Thanks, Eric. So the first case I want to talk about today is Moderna Therapeutics versus Prativa. And this is a case that came out of the PTAB back in 2019 and serves as a good teaching moment for a number of issues that can arise when an expert is trying to recreate experiments. So in Moderna, the challenge claims are related to these lipid nanoparticles that have a particular morphology. And here, the petitioner, Moderna, alleged that the morphological properties of these claimed nanoparticles were inherent in nanoparticles of a cited reference when made by the process using that cited reference. And to rebut this argument, the patent owner submitted a declaration by an expert that allegedly showed that experimental evidence demonstrating that lipid nanoparticles were generated using this process actually did not produce nanoparticles having that claimed morphology. So they were submitted a declaration saying Moderna was wrong. The PTAB ended up discounting this testimony for a few reasons. The first is that the expert admitted that the parameters for the tests were actually chosen in large part by the patent owner's counsel, which included, for example, the use of a manual syringe when, as the petitioner argued, an automatic syringe was actually typically used in the field. There was and then intentionally use of a low flow rate, which is known to result in variability of the morphological properties. Second, the patent owner's expert was actually a longtime employee of the patent owner, so which the PTAB suggested would cause the expert to be biased, and the patent owner could have actually relied on an independent third party, but instead chose not to. And then last, the patent owner's expert actually lacked relevant experience in the field of characterizing the morphology of the nanoparticles, so the board was not sure why this person was being held out as an expert in the first place. So in sum, the board actually did not find this declaration or any of the recreations of the experiments to be persuasive due really to the identity and selection of this expert. And the second case that I want to talk about is this Daikin versus Chemours, where sometimes it's necessary to deviate from the written words of an experiment that's in the cited reference to fill gaps and to show why a feature, for example, would be inherent. And an example of some of these pitfalls are described in good detail in this case. So in Daikin, the challenge claims are related to compositions comprising particular compounds. And the petitioner submitted a declaration from an expert seeking to show that a particular chemical transformation that was described in this reference necessarily provided this anticipatory compound, right? So this compound was created as part of the process of making some other compounds. The patent owner rebutted by arguing that the expert did not exactly reproduce the experiment as it was written in the example. And for example, the petitioner's expert used a longer reactor and heated it for a significantly and heated rather a longer portion of that reactor. So it was a tube. And they were heating more of it when they were recreating the experiment. And the patent owner argued that these changes fundamentally changed the reaction process relative to what was actually written in the cited reference. And so while it's not necessary to exactly replicate an example, any changes must be consistent with what's taught in the example itself. And any deviations from the reproduced experiment must be immaterial. And the reasons for these deviations have to be explained, as the board pointed out. And the petitioner did none of that. So they acknowledged that there were differences, but they failed to sufficiently show, according to the board, that the changes were immaterial and that the deviations would not have changed the output of the experiment, and then further failed to explain why they even made these deviations in the first place. So in sum, the board did not find the declaration particularly persuasive in deciding whether this reference actually did report these anticipatory compounds. So in light of these two cases, I'd like to kick back to you, Eric, and from the perspective of a litigator, what are some things that these cases can teach us, maybe about, for example, first identifying and choosing an expert?
Yeah, a couple of takeaways there. First, and it's a simple point, but get an expert with the right expertise. Think about that carefully. There's a tendency to say, I've got a scientist with great credentials, but not to focus enough on whether the credentials fit the issue that's in play in the case. Second, and it's another simple point, but important, it's worth the money to pay for a third-party expert and not to use your own scientist. It's just too easy to cross-examine the party scientist as biased. And then finally, I would say, make sure the expert that you hire to conduct experiments is not sort of the lofty testifying expert who hasn't been in a lab in 25 years. Because again, credibility is lost if the expert isn't somebody who actually gets his or her hands dirty in the lab conducting experiments on a regular basis. So it's important to think about those kinds of things when picking your expert.
And then once you actually have that expert, what are some other things we might need to think about or be careful about when recreating these experiments, for example?
Yeah, I'd say actually two more important points. First, as the lawyer, lawyers tend to want to be over-involved. Don't become the scientist. Don't try to design the experiment, because inevitably you're going to do something that deviates from what is both disclosed in the prior art and well understood science at the time. And therefore, you're going to expose your expert to cross-examination. Again, there's a tendency as the lawyer to want to get the right result. But if you try to game the experiment, you're going to end up exposing your expert to easy cross-examination, even if the ultimate result is correct. And then finally, be really careful to follow the protocols that are laid out in the prior art. And to the extent you have to deviate, and inevitably, you have to do something that goes beyond the reference, because the reference isn't going to lay out every single experimental condition. But if you do deviate, make sure you work with the expert to be very careful that any deviation, such as it is, or any addition to the protocol that's in the prior art, that's directly disclosed in the prior art reference, is something that is so common and well understood in the field that it would be automatic for an expert to do that. Because if you do something that requires any kind of invention or further innovation, you've already lost if what you're trying to do is establish inherency. So these sort of subtle points illustrate how difficult it is to get it just right. Now, on the flip side, in conclusion, if you do get it right and you can recreate an experiment and actually clearly show the inherent properties, it's really powerful evidence. The issue, though, is to survive cross-examination, that you played games with what was in the art in order to get the result without paying attention to whether you actually faithfully reproduced the prior art.
So I guess to kind of wrap everything up, what do you advise clients do in light of this information? I know, for example, in cases we've worked on together, we've had multiple experts, one running the experiment, another expert coming in and reviewing the actual results of that experiment. Is that something you think would be helpful for all clients, some clients? How would you advise?
Yeah, I would say I would raise two particular things to think about as you advise clients. One, make sure when you put the experiment together, you think very carefully about what the cross-examination is going to look like, and even work that through with the expert. Because till you have a sense of how well the expert's going to hold up in supporting the experimental protocol under cross-examination, it's really hard to advise your client on risk. And then second, you know, make sure your client understands the risk of this kind of evidence. It's not easy to prove inherency. It really isn't. It always sounds simple at the front end, because you know, you look at the prior art reference and say, of course, whatever's disclosed there must have had the features that are in the claims. But it turns out that even if you're right and you run the experiment and you get the right result, sometimes that experiment can be blown up on cross-examination, and your client needs to understand that risk as you advise on risk and outcomes.
Thank you very much, Eric. This has been super helpful. I hope everyone out there has enjoyed listening. If you have any other questions, please feel free to visit our website at www.choate.com. Both Eric and I are available on there if you have any other follow-ups. Thanks so much.
For more information, please visit www.choate.com. You can also listen to additional podcast episodes in the newsroom of our website and subscribe to them wherever you listen to podcasts, including iTunes, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. The information presented in this recording is for educational purposes only. It does not constitute legal advice for a specific situation. If you wish to obtain legal advice, you should retain an attorney and explain the facts of your particular situation.